Hi, and welcome to the Dr. Robin Show. This is the fifth radio show. Well, it used to be a weekly radio show. Now we're podcasting it. And please email us with any comments or questions. We're going to go over a couple of listeners' emails in a second. But it really helps because I want to address your concerns and your questions and comments. And today we're going to focus primarily on depression, which is a very depressing and a very common subject. But first, a couple of emails. First, Janet from Las Vegas asks, are omega-3s or food with the omega-3s the real thing, or is it a passing fad? And it seems almost weekly we have news stories on omega-3s, and I think that they are the real thing. There's a lot of evidence that fatty fish or taking fish oil capsules helps not only heart and stroke and maybe migraines, but at least several types of cancer. Actually, just this week, interestingly enough, there was a study reported on Swedish women who ate fatty fish like salmon, mackerel, or herring. I don't know too many women who eat herring, but maybe in the North countries. And in those women, they had a lower risk of kidney cancer. Now, one issue is taking omega-3 fatty acids as flaxseed oil or flaxseed, or better yet, fish oil, just as good as fish. And we don't really know. There's also an official prescription medicine, Omicor, I believe the name is, of omega-3s, and it may have omega-6s as well. But in most of the studies, eating fish once a week or even twice a month was enough to prevent some of the illnesses. One concern always is mercury in the supplements, and not too long ago they tested 10 of the top fish oil supplements for mercury, and they didn't have mercury. They also don't taste fishy. It doesn't leave a fishy aftertaste, but these are big capsules. If you have trouble swallowing big capsules, they look like vitamin E, you might have trouble with fish oil capsules. But then the issue is how much. They're usually 1,000 milligrams or 1,200 milligrams each capsule. And I think that generally we use one or two a day. I take one a day, and I think that there's a lot of solid evidence for it. Now, another email asked about the age of people and suicide. And classically, we always think of the highest suicide risks in general as adolescents or older people, particularly men with failing health and poor finances into their 60s and 70s. This may be changing, however. And interestingly enough, there was an article this week on age and suicide. In generally, they were talking about suicide rates have dropped since 1990 or so, probably due to recognition of depression, and also due probably to the medicines. Prozac and those meds became popular around 1990-1991. But interestingly enough, there seems to be a discrepancy in the ages of suicide as far as which ones are dropping. The rates have been dropping in the young and the old, but between 25 and 64 years old, the rates have been more or less steady with some ups and downs. So the good news is adolescence and early adulthood, they are dropping, and in after age 64 or so. Now, the main topic for today is depression. Depression really affects a lot of people. The prevalence, the lifetime prevalence, in other words, how many people in a lifetime get into at least a major depression or chronic mild depression, and it's about 17% of people. That's a whole lot of people. It affects most families, and really has a huge impact economically. I just read a report that depression costs the country at least $70 billion a year in lost work time, mostly disability, etc. And that's much more than any other illness. I think low back pain and headaches are right behind that, and diabetes also, but they pale in comparison to depression. Now, as you know, I'm joined here by my co-host, Susie Robbins, who's a social worker, and I'm going to talk a little bit about symptoms and treatment of depression, but Susie, any thoughts on depression?
What first comes to my mind is thinking of depression as if it's on a spectrum, as many other illnesses are also seen, in that you can have a mild depressive state, such as what is called being dysthymic, which basically means that you can get up in the morning, you can go to work, you can function pretty well, but inside you're feeling kind of crummy. But you're able to carry out what you need to do for the day. And that spectrum can go all the way to the other side, where someone could have a major depression where they can't get out of bed, they can't go to work, and they're not eating, and they just are feeling very, very sad all of the time. So I think that, to me, is, you know, speaks to how depression can come in very in mixed different packages.
I think when you say depression is feeling crummy, that really sums it up. It's a decreased poor quality of life is what it is. Some symptoms of depression are appetite changes, either increased or decreased. And interestingly enough, if you look at two major depressions 10 years apart in one person, they'll either gain or lose almost the exact same amount of pounds. So if they're 20 years old, they have a major depression and they lose 15 pounds, and then they're 30 years old and they have a big depression, they'll tend to lose 15 pounds again, or gain it, depending on, some people gain, some people lose. Sleep disturbances, some people sleep too much, and more commonly, people with depression are not sleeping and have insomnia. People with depression feel depressed. They feel blue and sad usually. Now, you can have a hidden depression where you don't feel depressed, but usually you do. Decreased motivation, not wanting to do very much as far as schoolwork or job, and what we call a loss of joy of life, joie de vivre. I took Spanish in high school. I didn't take French, but the joie de vivre, I think, sums it all up. In medical terms, we call that anhedonia. Really loss of pleasure and things. And I ask people, and when they say they are just not looking forward to anything, to the movies, to any of their usual fun activities, being with our kids, we know that we're probably dealing with depression. And we also look at family history and the person's past history, too. But family history, depression, like a lot of things, runs in families. And we look, was uncle, was mom, was dad depressed? Now, a lot of times it wasn't always recognized, so family histories can be tricky. Susie, any comments?
Thinking about how it is passed down, you know, if you knew Uncle Ernie had depression and now somebody else in the family has it, I'm wondering how closely linked is anxiety with depression, and is it almost always together?
Well, I don't think that they're always together, but very commonly, and it complicates things as far as treatment. But some people just feel down, and they're not particularly anxious. And the whole anxiety spectrum covers a wide range from generalized anxiety and worrying. There's basically, I see anxiety in two parts, either body anxiety, sort of like you have caffeine and you feel jittery, or more commonly the worrying type, where your mind is going and constantly worrying. And that does happen more with depression.
You know, I understand the component that you're saying, that it is, there is the genetic link there, and if the family has a gene for the depression, it's certainly going to continue to be passed down. But what about the old nurture versus nature? And let's say a person doesn't have the gene for depression, but grew up in a very dysfunctional, very difficult family. How does that play into having depression for the rest of your life?
Ah, yes, the old nature versus nurture, and it's very interesting. And I tend to think that in most illnesses, most problems, such as depression, there's a major genetic component and then a major environmental component, whether it's 50-50 or 60-40, and in some individuals it's more or less. But interestingly enough, there's been recent studies on what we call the serotonin transporter gene. And the bottom line, if you look at somebody's serotonin transporter gene, you can predict with 98% accuracy how they're going to cope with difficulties in their life. Now, this whole serotonin transporter gene stuff is a future podcast, and we would have to spend a long time on it. But the bottom line is people do have genetic tendencies towards depression and towards coping, and then their environment influences it. So say you're born with a tendency towards depression, but it's not real strong genetically, and you have a wonderful childhood, which most people don't, but you may skip the depressive component. Or if you are born with a mild tendency towards depression genetically, and your childhood is very tough and stressful, it's more likely, of course, that you're going to have recurring chronic depression.
Well, what about for all the parents listening out there who may have an adolescent or adult child who is currently battling depression, who did have a nurturing, loving environment growing up? Is it possible just to be depressed without having the nature part also being a key component to this?
Yes, and absolutely. A lot of people have great parents, great childhoods, and are depressed all their life, pointing out the genetic physical component of it. Now, one question that always comes up is, am I depressed because I have a day or two of feeling down? And technically, really, no. It has to go on for at least a few weeks with some depressive symptoms, or at least feeling fairly depressed. And usually it goes on, of course, for months. There's a natural course in most people's major depression where they get severely depressed, but it might take 6 to 12 months to get better, and we don't always want to wait for that, because there's evidence that more depression gets more depression. If we don't treat it, people are more likely to be depressed in 1 and 2 and 5 years. And what I think is really undertreated is more what Susie mentioned a minute ago as dysthymia, which is mild or mild to moderate chronic depression. Lately, I've had a number of people, more in adolescents, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, tell me that they've actually secretly been mildly depressed for 2, 3, 4, 6 years, but really haven't told anybody. Susie, any thoughts?
Well, as you're talking about dysthymia, I agree with you that it can certainly be under the radar. There must be thousands of people, maybe millions of people, who go through their whole life being dysthymic without getting help for it, because they can function, as we were saying before, they can do what they need to do during their day, whereas major depression is very blatant, and usually family members are able to see that there is a depression there and help the individual seek help.
You know, I think there's a number of conditions where the severe end of the condition gets treated and the milder ones don't. You look at ADD, ADHD, it's the kid who's the boy who's 8 years old, who's jumping up and down in the classroom, who's disrupting things, who can't sit for more than 1 millisecond. He's the one who gets treated and recognized. But the girl who's sitting there who's just poor attention, who doesn't have hyperactivity, who's at the milder end of the ADHD spectrum, they don't get treated necessarily. And I think that happens with depression. With a mild depression, people sort of internalize it. They keep it to themselves. They don't talk about it that much. Maybe they'll mention it to a good friend or spouse, maybe not, or to the doctor. But the people with severe depression end up non-functional, and sometimes there's an intervention. There's more likely to be treatment. Now, what are the consequences of depression? Well, people lose their jobs. They lose their relationships. A lot of lost relationships and broken marriages, and people get just tired of being with somebody who's severely depressed, not paying any attention to the kids, not bringing home money, etc., etc. And we always worry about suicide. Suicide actually kills about a million people a year worldwide, which is more than wars and murders. And traditionally we think of risk of suicide, well, one risk group is older men with failing health with financial problems, but with more severe depression, anybody is at risk for suicide. A lot of people with depression self-medicate, get into substance abuse, and that can raise your risk for suicide. So we're always worried about suicide. There seems to be a genetic component there's a lot going on in the brain in people who have active suicidal thoughts. Some people are severely depressed and really never think about suicide, or they know and their physician knows and their spouse knows they would never actually do it. Other people obsess about suicide. And I think that there's a lot going on in the brain physically with different genes, etc., to people who are obsessing about suicide. Now, how do we really treat depression? Outside of medicine, exercise sometimes helps a little bit, even if it only helps 10 or 15%. I don't promise people that if they go and exercise, they're going to feel great afterwards. People who are depressed generally feel depressed right afterwards. But if they keep at it, after 3 or 4 weeks, what we see is people do have a little more energy, sometimes feel a bit better about themselves, because depression really takes its toll on your self-esteem. So I think exercise is probably worth it. Therapy, seeing a therapist, I think, is a wonderful thing. Sometimes I think that the whole world needs to see a therapist. Susie, as a social worker, what are your thoughts about therapy and depression?
That it can only help and enhance the individual. But as you're talking about, you know, ways of treating depression, I would say that therapy would probably work the best when it's used alongside with the appropriate medicine that the person is on in treating their depression. Using one or the other can help, but using both is probably the best indicator of the person getting healthier.
You know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of studies on, there's actually been very well done studies on depression. Blinded studies where they use placebo versus the real medicine, but also where they do therapy versus just watchful waiting and telling people they're going to get therapy, things like that. And out of the large NIH studies, my reading is that basically if you leave depression alone, a major depression, people will cycle out of it, but it might take 9 or 12 months or longer, or they may not cycle out of it, and there's the risk for their life falling apart and suicide. If you use medicine, antidepressants, or therapy, you have a certain percentage chance of getting better. Most people get better. But the combination works much better than either alone. So we do push the combination of therapy and medicine. Now, Susie, people always ask, what really goes on in therapy? People have, I think, preconceived misconceptions about what therapy is like. What does go on in therapy?
Well, I think the most important thing for a person in when they're seeking a therapist and having made the decision that they want to go into, quote, therapy, is the feeling of, where do I even start? I've been alive for 50 years. How can I go to somebody I don't know and start talking about my life to them? Where would I start? And I like to think of an old saying that I remember learning in grad school is that the therapist starts where the individual wants to start. Wherever that may be, when you walk in the room with your therapist, is where you're going to begin. And I think as the individual going to see a therapist, what is most important when they start is that they can begin to have a trusting relationship with that professional. Because what you want to be able to do is to go in there and speak freely, knowing that that professional sitting in the same room with you is listening to you and is going to keep with whatever you are talking about between the two of you so that you can really talk freely and openly.
And, you know, I think that people don't want to go into their childhood for years like the old analysis might have done, but really, the first thing that people often say in therapy, the first session is, you know, I had a pretty good childhood. And then 10 sessions later, they realize how dysfunctional it was. So it's not as if you have to dwell on your childhood for eons or for years, but to talk about it a little bit in this session or that session, I think can be very helpful. But isn't it true also, therapists don't really give advice. People think that they're going to be telling me what to do. You know, get rid of my husband, quit my job, et cetera, et cetera. They're more facilitators. It's a self-discovery process, isn't it?
Yes, that's a very good term to use. I think what the therapist can do for you is to help you reflect in your own life what the patterns of your behavior are and how you can recognize them and move forward from that. You know, years ago when people went into therapy, they would most likely go into what was called psychoanalysis, where they would meet with the therapist 3, 4, maybe even 5 times a week, and they would just free associate whatever was on their mind that day. They would just talk about maybe their dreams, what they dreamt about the night before. I think now in the year 2006, people are coming in talking much more about what is going on in their lives right now that's causing them some concern, what they need to do to move forward with their lives. Many times somebody will come or seek to go into therapy because of a situation, whether it be a family member who has died, a divorce that may be happening, becoming ill. And in fact, that's many times the way somebody will go into therapy, is because of a situation that has arisen. It also brings to mind that many people who may choose not to see an individual therapist will seek out a group, where it will be a group of individuals possibly going through the same situation, say a divorce or a cancer, and they will have a facilitator there, but it's the group of individuals who really work and talk together.
And you've run groups before in several various types of groups.
Yes, especially within a high school setting with adolescents who came in, they came in all with the same issue. One was at an urban high school where the kids in the group all had a hearing loss. And, you know, they talked about how it was to cope within a large school environment where they had to communicate in different ways with people.
You know, it's interesting. I ask people all the time to see a therapist, and generally the barriers to therapy are time and money, and they don't know who to see. Time is a problem. People have to travel to and from the therapy and spend an hour, and if it's not right nearby, convenient. Although, there's been some recent studies on telephone therapy. Not initially, but if people establish an alliance with a good therapist, and then they did phone therapy for depression, etc., once a week or so on the phone, it worked just as well, or actually better. There were less missed appointments, and people still connected, so they did well over a year just doing it on the phone mostly, once they established the initial time with a person. I don't like people just doing internet therapy or phone therapy with somebody they never met. But money is an issue with insurance. Most therapists don't take insurance, and then people bill their PPO and try to collect some. But finding a therapist, you know, I have some thoughts, but Susie, who do you think in general makes the best therapist, or is it really the individual person?
Well, a therapist is a generic word for somebody within a helping profession who will see an individual on a regular basis. That could be a psychiatrist who also might be prescribing medicines for the individual. It could be a psychologist with a PhD or a PsyD degree. It could also be a social worker who would see the individual on a regular basis. To say who makes the best therapist really depends on the fit for that individual. Some people who require medicine and therapy, say somebody that's going through a depression, might feel comfortable seeing the psychiatrist for both therapy and medicine, whereas many others would rather go to a psychiatrist, an MD for the medicine, and see a social worker once a week for therapy.
You know, I think ideally, if somebody went to a psychiatrist and they got the medicines, and that psychiatrist also did therapy, that's the ideal situation. But in this day and age, in the United States, it doesn't usually work out that way, because most psychiatrists are just dealing with medicine. Some are decent therapists, some are not. I think with therapists, it's a bell-shaped curve. You have your average, mediocre therapists, your poor ones. What you want to do is find somebody in the top 10 or 20% of therapists who's very talented, who's kept up on the literature, etc. And also, for one person, one therapist might not be the best therapist for another person. So sometimes for an adolescent girl, we'll want maybe a younger woman or a woman and not a male therapist. For an older man, sometimes an older male therapist might be better. And so I go for the individual, but finding a therapist can be tough. If you don't have a good recommendation from friends or your doctors, you can look in the Yellow Pages or look online, but it can be difficult to know who's who. And then the money issues are always an issue. There are a lot of good mental health services that are publicly funded with terrific therapists. They're usually, say, mental health services of your county or family services of your town. So it's called Family Service Center or Family Services. And very often they have very good therapists. Susie, any thoughts?
You know, it's a good point about, you know, the community mental health centers. Sometimes that's a good place to start and talking to them. And if it doesn't seem like the right fit, they may at the very least be able to give you some names of some private therapists in the area. Another plus for the mental health centers for the community is that they typically are on a sliding scale, which means their fees to you will be based on your income. You know, as you mentioned earlier, that a lot of people are fearful of therapy because of the cost, and understandably so, especially if it's not being covered by insurance. So if there is a need for therapy and the concern for being able to pay for it is there, it might be a good place to start is at a mental health community center. But also keep in mind that you might have to be on a waiting list, that you might not be able to start right away.
That's a very good point. And how about the length of time of therapy? There's been a movement that started a number of years ago because of insurance and HMOs towards short-term therapy, 5 or 10 sessions. What do you think about the length of time?
Oh, I think it certainly depends upon the individual. You know, if somebody is seeking therapy for a short-term situation where they feel that they can discuss something and move on from there, maybe 8-10 sessions is all that they would need. Sometimes that's all insurance will pick up too if they are able to bill insurance with it. In other situations, say for major depression and or certainly dysthymia too, the individual may seek and need to be in therapy for much longer than that. I think it obviously, like anything, it depends upon the individual. You know, and sometimes people will be in therapy for, say, 3 or 4 months and ask the therapist, say, hey, I'm feeling okay now. I just want to take a break, but I have a feeling I'll want to come back. And, you know, sometimes that's okay, too, to go for as long as you feel you need it, saying you're going to leave but come back. And I think that also gives the individual the feeling of, hey, when I need to go back to my therapist, I know that I can.
Yeah, I think very well said. It really varies, but I think in general, the more the merrier with therapy, but money and time do become an issue. And if it is about one discrete problem, say your kid is having a problem and you and your husband, or you need to go just go in to see, or say you're having a problem with an aging parent or something, and just work out what to do about that problem, a limited number of sessions can be very helpful. But I think that many people do need 6, 12 months or longer of good therapy. And what about other types of therapy like marital or family therapy?
Well, that's a good point. Not all therapy is solo where you go in by yourself. As we mentioned a minute ago, group therapy is very popular where you would go in with a group of strangers, people that you don't know, and work together on issues that you'd have in common. Couples therapy is also very popular, or marital therapy. It's also very difficult. Many people maybe wish that they could do marital therapy, but maybe just one of the spouses wants to do it, the other doesn't want to do it. But certainly there's the benefit if they can both go in together and work with a therapist. There's also family therapy, where if a whole family together is wrestling with an issue or issues, where the family goes in together and works with a therapist, where, you know, if the whole family can't be there that week, then they're not going to have the session where they really do it all together. And there's a whole, you know, within the whole field of therapy, people have different beliefs on what the best kind of therapy is, individual versus group or family therapy.
And I think even if people can't go in as a family, and it's hard to get everybody into therapy or they won't go, a lot of therapists see the individual within the context of the family, and it's called family dynamics or family therapy, and they consider themselves family therapists, even if they're just seeing an individual. And I think that's very important. If you take an adolescent, for instance, 14-year-old with some depression or anxiety, it's not happening just out of the blue in isolation. There's a family, there's dynamics going on, there's a whole lot. There's a history there. Now, what are our goals for treating depression? Basically, we want to treat to remission, which is where people don't have mild clinical depression or mild symptoms of depression. Is that always possible? Well, not always. Only about 80% of people with depression get benefits from treatments. And if you kick up the medicines and use alternative two or three medicines, etc., you might be able to get to 85%. But we still have a ways to go with medicines and with treatments. But that means that the majority of people do get a lot of help with depression. We want to treat to where they don't have depression. And with a major depression, we want to treat with medicine for at least a year. Now, outside of medicine we were talking, there's one other treatment I want to talk about, which is bright light therapy for seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. And there's actually groups for and support groups for SAD. There's also very good support groups for depression, like DBSA, the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance out of Chicago, but it's a nationwide group. They're very good, and they have a good website. I think that the goals for depression are to treat to remission whether we're using medicine or not, and bright light therapy can help for seasonal depression or even people who just have worse depression when the light levels go down in winter. And it may seem bright in January on a bright sunny day, but the lux, that's LUX, the intensity of the light, is actually much decreased over July, even if it looks just as bright. And that light gets in through the skin and is very important in our moods and depression. So what people have done is fixed up a bank of bright lights, and they get it from several companies, and they sit there by the bank of bright lights, and it's a full spectrum light for a half an hour a day during lower light levels, usually October through March or so. And in many people, this has been well tested in large, very well done studies. Many people, it eases their depression or helps to a great deal with therapy or medicine. Now, they did tests on this versus placebo, where they had fake light or sham light, and it seemed just as high intensity, but it was only 1,000 lux versus 10,000. And people need that 10,000 lux intensity of the light for half an hour a day. So they have to sit not near the bank of lights, but pretty close, within a foot and a half, because each inch after that you move away, the intensity goes way down. So it's not as if people can just have a bright room with fluorescent lights and they'll feel better. It doesn't really affect the depression very much at all. They need that bright bank of lights. And there's a couple of companies. One is the Sunbox Company, I believe out of Tennessee, and the other is Northern Lights Technology out of Montreal, Canada, I believe. And they sell for about $200 a nice bright light that lasts quite a while. Usually they have 20% off coupons, etc. So outside of medicine, we do try what we can. Now, we're running a little short of time. Next week, we'll talk about medicines for depression, and we might get into bipolar. We're just talking about regular depression here, unipolar, but we might get into what's very common is bipolar depression. We've been talking about an illness where at least 75 or 80% of people can get better or completely cured for the moment, at least. And so we're talking about a problem where people really do need to go get help and get their family members help for. And please email us with any concerns or comments or questions, we'll certainly do them on the next show. Thank you very much, and have a good week.